From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harris. From Star Wars to the Marvel Universe, sci-fi films dominate the box office.
Tell me something. What do you know about Wakanda?
It's a third world country. Textiles, shepherds, cool outfits.
A scene from Marvel's Black Panther. Science fiction has come a long way on screens, large and small. Today we hear about a new AMC show that explores the evolution of science fiction movies. That's ahead this hour, but first, last week we talked with drummer Bron Daler of the popular heavy metal band Mastodon. The group took the Grammy for Best Metal Performance this January.
Oh my God! You guys, we just won a Grammy. Thanks to my beautiful wife, Suzanne. She's up there. I love you.
And we asked for your favorite Georgia-born band. This is what Jared Hutchins from Gainesville, Georgia had to say.
My favorite is Deathclaw. They are from the show Metalocalypse on Adult Swim, based in Atlanta, and they are just amazing. One of my absolute favorites.
So we love hearing from you. Give us a call at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the program. Okay, are you ready for another season of Stranger Things on Netflix? That is just one of the many entertainment projects wearing the Made in Georgia sticker. Is there an actual sticker?
Jennifer? I think there's a Georgia Peach logo.
There's the Peach
sure.
logo, right? Okay. Those productions are contributing to the state's multi-billion dollar local entertainment industry. So what else is setting up shop here? Let's go on set in Georgia.
Here we go. Movie!
We make films.
Movies? Let's go to the movies.
Let's go see the stars.
Atlanta Journal-Constitution reporter Jennifer Brett writes for the AJC's Atlanta Buzz blog. Jennifer, welcome back. Good morning.
Good morning.
Where do you want to start? We'll start with Stranger Things.
Yeah, and what I love about the season that's filming right now is they have gone back to the future, setting up shop at Gwinnett Place Mall, turning it into a vintage food court mall experience. My colleague Rodney Aho has a great blog post up about this on AJC.com. They've got the Orange Julius sign, the Walden books, there's a game arcade. There's even a jazzercise studio, so it's going to go right back to that era in time.
Okay, so let's listen to the show's creator. His name is Matt Duffer. He's speaking with CBS News.
We knew it would appeal, or thought it would appeal, to the people who grew up like us, loving these movies from the 80s. And then what we were hoping and praying was that it would also work for a newer, younger generation. You know, I think one of the reasons Stranger Things worked is there were a lot of people we were able to bring in who we felt are very talented, but who were also inspired by the same films that we were, so we were all speaking the same language.
Hey, Jennifer, do you get an opportunity to watch all of these shows? I mean, I can remember watching the first season of Stranger Things. It was really good.
Yes.
But I totally missed the second season. Do you get an opportunity to watch?
Yeah, you got
to
push pause in your life and make room for that so you're ready for season three. And I think season three is going to establish an opportunity for parents to have a very important conversation with their children. And that conversation is going to go like this. Once upon a time, son, you went to a place called the Radio Shack. And you could get a fax machine or an answering machine or a telephone or a camera. And today, of course, your phone does all that. So I think it's going to be a fantastic anthropological experience in addition to all the ghoulish monsters.
Okay, that's hilarious because essentially Radio Shack is gone, right? You can't find or very few Radio Shacks, right?
Yes, Radio Shack is... among the vintage logos we're going to see in this season.
But we're happy that radio is still around.
Yes.
Thank you very much. Okay, so people can't seem to get enough of The Walking Dead on AMC. Is it just The Walking Dead? Or how many spinoff shows are there now?
Well, there's Fear of the Walking Dead and, goodness gracious, I think the Walking Dead, has, legs and life,
legs
pardon
and
the
life.
Pun.
That's funny. Again, okay, so production, lights, cameras, downtown Atlanta?
The Walking Dead filmed at what I think is probably the most appropriate place for any place to film in the state of Georgia. That's at the state capitol, the place where all these film credits were established in 2008 that has lured a steady stream of filming projects our way.
Okay, so this is a bit of a clip from Rick and Negan. Is that correct, Negan?
He's the bad guy.
Yeah, this is a showdown, I think, from season 8.
Your people are down.
I'll get out of it. I always do.
just you and me, Rick. And you, you are torn open.
Okay, is that from season 7? Is that season 8? Yeah, the seasons again?
They blur together in your head. But Governor Nathan Deal, on his way out as Georgia's governor and as a very a strong proponent of these tax credits, he posted some photos the other day of himself posing with Norman Reedus after Walking Dead took over the state capitol to film some scenes. The state capitol has actually been a filming location in the past for projects including Selma, the movie Selma,
yes.
Ride Along 2. A couple of Hallmark movies filmed there as well. So I think it's funny when people come right back to the to the source, to the ground zero of a Georgia state tax credit.
So we absolutely. So we know that horror continues to be a really hot genre, and sci-fi is rolling along as well.
Yes.
Boss Level, right? That's a new film that's being shot in Atlanta.
This is Boss Level. Frank Grillo, Mel Gibson. The plot is a retired special forces officer is trapped in a never-ending time loop on the day of his death. So I'm thinking it's sort of like Groundhog Day, only with more explosions and car crashes. And this has been filming in downtown Atlanta. They filmed at Underground Atlanta just the other day, and the movie production folks were good enough to put signs everywhere saying, if you hear gunfire, it's just a pretend, it's just simulated, no cause for alarm. So it's always kind of fun to watch them set up shop and take over. So you're definitely going to spot Atlanta in this one.
Well, how about Avengers? Infinity War, filmed in Georgia, just hit a major milestone. It is now, let's see here, the fifth highest grossing film of all time.
Yeah.
Why do you think people are still so fascinated with this universe? And we'll talk about the expanding Marvel Universe in a second here.
Well, not only do they have, fantastic special effects, sight gags and such, they're just great stories. I mean, in addition to all the superhero powers and, the supervillains and the superheroes and all their narratives intertwining, you could take away, in my opinion, all the, the special effects and starships and whatnot, and you would still have a great movie because the story is so strong. And speaking of Marvel, our next Marvel production to come out of Atlanta is going to be Ant-Man and the Wasp. This is due out July 6th.
July 6th?
Yep. Look for Atlanta in this one for sure. The trailer is out, and I was able to spot a number of local spots in this one.
Okay, so let's listen to a clip from Ant-Man.
So, how long have you been Ant-Man again?
Not long. It just sort of happened.
I wish I could fight bad guys like you.
I seem to mess it up almost every time.
Okay, so what makes these movies... I know I'm probably... Well, maybe. I'm opening up a can of worms here, but what makes these movies...
Can of ants, you mean?
A can of ants! Duh. sci-fi, I mean, they're big action movies... Is it just add a superpower and now you've made it sci-fi?
I think who wouldn't want to be able to either fly or control time or have a huge hammer that, can bust up things or who wouldn't want to be able to turn into a giant monster and smash things? And in Paul Rudd's case, who wouldn't want to be able to turn into a very tiny yet very powerful superhero?
So you really enjoy these films?
I'm embracing it.
Okay, another Georgia project. Taraji P. Henson.
Yes.
Is she in town now making
Welcome
this film?
Welcome back, Taraji. Mm. Of course, she's no stranger to Atlanta and the local filmmaking scene. She starred in Hidden Figures, which filmed here, and that... That got all kinds of acclaim. She also starred in Tyler Perry's latest Acrimony, which was a really interesting departure for him. Coming up next, she stars as a sports agent who can hear men's secret thoughts in What Men Want, which is filming now. This is a takeoff on the Mel Gibson What Women Want.
That's
so
right.
So I don't know. He's in town doing Boss Level. Maybe they'll make something happen. Wouldn't be surprised to see maybe Mel popping up in a cameo.
So here's Taraji in an interview with Entertainment News talking about What Men Want.
Exactly what women want. Loyalty, to feel safe, someone they get along with, loyalty. I think that's what most people want in a relationship.
I've got a few more I want to get in here. The Melissa McCarthy comedy, Life of the Party. That's out now in theaters?
Yeah, this is out now. Debuted on Friday. I got a chance to go down and talk to Melissa McCarthy and her husband, Ben Falcone, the director. They had their world premiere at Auburn University, and the reason for that was the studio folks had a nationwide competition to see, which college campus could give them, I guess, the most social media love. Auburn did it, so we went down to Opelika to see this, although it filmed here at Agnes Scott College, Clayton State University. There was a particularly hilarious scene that filmed at the Optimist restaurant, and it was set at quote-unquote fictitious Decatur University. So it was kind of a local production, but Auburn nabbed the world premiere from us. So this was a really fun movie. About Melissa McCarthy stars as a newly and cruelly divorced mom who decides to go back to school. So she does what anybody would do in this situation. She goes back to college where her kid is in school and moves into the dorm and starts partying like it's, you know, like 1999? She's just back in the day.
Okay. Yeah. So here's a clip from Life of the Party.
I don't regret staying at home and being your mom, but I regret not getting my degree. That's why somebody's mom just enrolled in college. I'm referring to myself. I'll see you around the quad.
So Melissa is one of these stars that's decided there's so much production going on here. Why not get a place, right?
Yeah. In fact, she told me that she actually has a place here. She and Ben are going to have, you know, set down some roots here in Atlanta. They've been part of a number of locally filmed projects. She was in Identity Thief with Jason Bateman a few years ago, filmed The Boss here. Ben Falcone was the director of that. He appeared in What to Expect When You're Expecting. So they do lots of work here. So why not become Atlanta residents? It looks like they're going to come on down.
Netflix is busy in Georgia. What are some of the latest projects in the works? I know Ozark.
Yeah, in addition to Stranger Things, Ozark, this is Jason Bateman. He stars in, directs, executive produces. This project there, it's obviously set at Lake of the Ozarks, but actually it films at Lake of the Alatoona and Lake Lanier at some point. And they've actually bought a marina up there, that Blue Cat Lodge that you see sometimes. They do so much filming there, they figured instead of just, you know, renting it out for whatever needs they have, they just went ahead and bought it. So they're putting down some roots here for sure.
So, Jennifer, what else are you watching? What else in this film industry that's just blowing up here in Georgia is of interest to you?
Well, I think what's, you know, it's always cool to see a movie filming and, you know, to spot a movie star eating here or there or, you know, showing up wherever. But I think what's also interesting is the state of Georgia is being very proactive about laying the groundwork for this to be an economic engine for generations to come, namely the Georgia Film Academy, which is headquartered right across the street from the Pinewood Studios facilities where a lot of these Marvel movies and other productions film. This is down there. Jeffrey Sefikoff is their executive director. They've been really proactive and smart about sort of creating the next generation of folks who can work on and, on set, behind the camera, maybe in front of the camera. But these, you know, kids are getting, you know, the training that they need so productions can continue to rely on Georgia's film crew industry community to, you know, to make all these productions happen. Because, you know, you can have the greatest stars in the world and whatnot and director and screenwriter, but it's, you know, it's these folks behind the scene who really make it happen.
And we still need bodies in Georgia, Georgia-trained bodies for these productions.
Yeah, sometimes, right? I'll even hear about, you know, productions having trouble finding enough crew because there's just so much work, which is a terrific problem to have. So I think the Georgia Film Academy is a really smart move by the state of Georgia to continue moving this to the next level.
That is Atlanta Journal Constitution reporter Jennifer Brett. She writes for the AJC's Atlanta Buzz blog. Jennifer, great to see you as always.
See you soon.
That's fun. It's on Second Thought. I'm Tony Harris. Before the break, we talked about some current film and television projects in Georgia. One of those from Netflix is the movie Candy Jar, which premiered last month. It stars Christina Hendricks and Helen Hunt. Candy Jar follows two high school debate champions focused on getting into college.
This is the Hemlock Prep Academy Debate Club.
How many members do you have?
Two.
She and I.
Her and I.
Her and myself.
Him and me, myself and I.
Frankly, I've already forgotten what club you're here arguing.
Debate!
One person who worked behind the scenes of Candy Jar is Curtis Bonds Baker of Atlanta. He's a unit photographer, which means he takes photos on set. His other credits include a number of TV shows, including Stranger Things, Lore, and Scream. On Second Thoughts, Kalina Bowler talked with Baker, who says he wants to be invisible on set.
That's part of the pressure of photographing on set, is you want to make sure you capture what that scene is about in one photograph.
So then are you, as a still photographer, do you get to sit in on some of the creative meetings, like with the DP and the director, and say, so you can at least see or hear or get an understanding of their vision?
Not necessarily.
Okay.
But during the day, I'd say yes, because a lot of times I kind of fade into the shadows and I'm always watching. My whole day is my eyes are scanning the room. I watch the director. If he's approaching the actors, that's a shot people like, is your director's talking to actors.
Right.
Actors goofing off or just, you know, between takes being themselves. I learn from everybody on set. I watch every single position, the grips, the electricians, the rest of my camera team. Definitely the director of photography, directors. I watch them and how they work. And I watch them discussing and I get to listen to what they're talking about. So in a non-official way, yes, I do listen in on creative thinking. It doesn't really affect my job. I do like to see what's going to happen next so I can start thinking about if they're going to put the camera there, that might be a good shot for me. I need to know at least a little bit of what's happening in the scenes so that if there's an important moment, I need to make sure I'm there for that.
So where in the world does your fascination with the lens, with cameras, where does it come from? Were you always into it?
No. In 2008, I'd say I was just not even really thinking about becoming a photographer. I've always had a camera. Growing up, everybody's got cameras.
Right.
But started getting serious about it. I took a motorcycle trip to Alaska on a big BMW motorcycle with five other guys that were in the commercial industry here in Atlanta. We took about 2 years of planning, and then we went to Alaska. I took a very small point and shoot that I kept in my jacket pocket, and I would literally, while I had my right hand on the throttle, I would reach into my left pocket with my left hand and take pictures left-handed of things on the side of the road and just stick it back in there, zip it up.
Is that your dominant hand?
And no, the shoot was your right hand, but okay. You need that right hand for the throttle, so you can't take that off. And then I started using, some of our friends' independent films you and I have both been on a couple things.
Yeah.
And back when people were trying to get their start or try different, different careers, I just brought my camera to set and started shooting and really liked the idea of capturing an image of maybe one day somebody iconic and having that picture, you see that pop up every once in a while. And I mean, Taxi Driver is a movie that mm-hmm. speaks to me just because of the imagery. And I've got the book of all the photographs, and there's just some full big page pictures of Robert De Niro in a mohawk just staring right at the camera.
Yeah.
And those kind of things really speak to me. I mean, looking at pictures from the, behind the scenes of Star Wars, like photographs like that of just the actors hanging out. And I've always loved to be able to see past the lit sets and the perfect everything. And I liked seeing the behind the scenes. I like pictures of Keith Richards of the Rolling Stones passed out behind a curtain when Annie Leibovitz was photographing them backstage.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's what really drives me, is just kind of getting something that might one day be iconic.
You've spoken extensively about your work on Stranger Things and how proud you are of it. What are some other projects, other productions that you feel like I'm really proud to say I did work, good work on this one?
Mm-hmm. The one I'm on right now actually just comes to mind, Miracle Workers, which I'm sure it won't be out until mid 2018 or so.
Uh-huh.
But the cast is great. The people I'm working for at Turner or TBS, the photo editors and the people that hire me, they've been great. They're so easy to work with. I mean, the emails are typically very professional when you're dealing with big studios, but these guys have been very laid back, and there's, we'll throw a joke here and there, and it's one of those, five or six of us are on the same email. They've been nice, and they'll come by and pick up a hard drive and stuff like that, but it makes it easier for me. So this set currently has been great, and I feel like I'm getting good stuff because I have a good rapport with the actors. And being able to walk up to an actor and be right in his face to get a cool shot, and they have no problem with it, makes my job so much easier.
Yeah.
There's some, I have worked with actors that don't really want you taking pictures of them, and that just makes it a little more frustrating because I'm here to do a job. They're not, these photos aren't for me, they're for the show, so it's not a personal thing. But I worked on Lore, which came out on Amazon. It's based off the Lore podcast.
Yeah, I love it.
Those were six or seven, I don't remember how many episodes, but six or seven episodes, and very different. So new cast, new director each time. But a couple of those actors were a big surprise where they didn't care if I was in their face or in their eye line, just said, shoot all you want. And those kind of experiences are great. It really comes down to good cast, good crew. I love working on shows that have, as a period piece, like Stranger Things was 1980s,
mm-hmm.
and being able to, every photograph came out as if it was taken in that time was fun because you have the wardrobe and all the props match. So it's nice to do things where people were fully dressed in a time period. So that Lore, and we did a great movie with Jeremy Irons called An Actor Prepares, which isn't out yet.
Mm-hmm.
But Jeremy Irons was somebody, you know, a very legendary, someone that's been around for a long time.
Yeah.
Just a complete, I mean, beyond the word gentleman, but he was very fatherly. He was very nice to everyone. He was, you know, very affectionate. I mean, he'd hold your arm while he talked to you. And
yeah.
I got pulled in and cast as the wedding photographer during a wedding scene. So I'm in there with Jeremy and...
Oh, you're in the scene.
Yeah, they pulled me in. So I went to wardrobe and got me a shirt and a blazer.
Nice.
So I had to pretend to be a photographer. So, you know, Jeremy Irons comes up and adjusts my collar and, you know, makes sure my wardrobe's correct. And, you know, right up in my face with his hand-rolled cigarettes and just blowing smoke in my face. But that's one of those little highlights of your life of working in this business is when you have these experiences. Similar experience on this current show, which I'm not going to say anything about it because it'll be giving stuff away, mm-hmm. but I had access to an actor, and it was just one of these rare things where, like, I can't believe that I got to be there for that. Leave everybody in suspense for what that was. But it's been nice to just be on shows with good cast, good crew, basically, and good light. I like shooting with light.
That's Curtis Bonds Baker. He is a unit photographer working in Atlanta. One of his latest projects is the Netflix movie Candy Jar, produced by Atlanta's Judy Cairo. He spoke to On Second Thought's Kalina Bowler. She hosts the Credits Podcast. Listen online at thecreditspodcast.com. So this weekend, Avengers: Infinity War became the fifth highest grossing film of all time. It was produced in Georgia and follows a long list of other commercially successful sci-fi films. A new series on AMC looks at the evolution of the genre. It's called James Cameron's Story of Science Fiction. Lisa Jazyk appears in the series. She's a professor of science fiction studies at Georgia Tech. Lisa, good to have you on the program.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
Enough of the pleasantries because we've got a lot of ground to cover and you are so interesting. How did you get the role on the program?
It was great. They called me, Left Right Production Studios, who was managing the whole series, called me up and they said, we want to talk to scholars about this series we're putting together and do you have a few minutes to chat with us? And I said, yeah, that sounds interesting. I'd love to talk. And then 3 hours later, they were like, wow, that's really interesting. Would you actually like to come and film for the show sometime? And I thought, that's wonderful. I hadn't realized we were doing an audition right then and there, but I have to admit, it felt a lot like doing my PhD exams all over again because I had to know everything and I never knew what question was coming at me, but it was cool.
So wait a minute, you were in all six episodes.
Yes, I am.
What did you think of the experience?
The experience was fantastic. It was really exciting. We always talk in the science fiction community about how awesome it is that like authors and fans and editors all know each other and our boundaries are very fluid. And so as someone who works primarily with print science fiction and with the written word, it was really exciting to get to go talk to professionals who make visual science fiction and to learn about how they do it.
So according to the network, and I need you to make sense of this, the show explores the evolution of science fiction from its cult beginnings and pulp to, I'm just reading this, okay, to the engine for blockbuster film and television success today. What does that mean?
Well, I think what it is it's true. Most people, right, get their experiences of science fiction through visual media, primarily through movies and television, but increasingly also through web series and video games. So for a lot of people, they know there's a long history of science fiction going back to some woman maybe named Mary Shelley who wrote a book called Frankenstein 200 years ago this year. But they don't know a lot about how you get from Mary Shelley to James Cameron, right? And so this show really does, I think, a cool job of trying to provide context for the kinds of visual science fiction we know so much. And so it goes back through the history, not just of visual science fiction, but print science fiction and how the two interact.
So what does Mary Shelley mean to science fiction?
She means everything to science fiction, right? She gave us some of our most iconic characters. She gave us the mad scientist, the misunderstood creature, the victimized woman, unfortunately, but, you know, got to do what we got to do here. and she taught us that we can value science and technology, but that we also need to respect its social dimensions and its moral dimensions, and that you can never separate the two.
Okay, so I want to play a bit of sound from the show. We have a clip from one of the episodes. This is George Lucas speaking with James Cameron about his views on science fiction.
Mm-hmm. I come out of anthropology.
Yeah.
So my focus is social systems.
Right.
And in science fiction, you got two branches. One is science.
Yeah.
And the other is social.
Right.
I'm much more of the 1984 kind of guy.
Okay, so to hear George Lucas talk, good sci-fi is populist in nature. And I wonder if you agree with this, where the little guy is taking on the empire. All right, that's clear in Star Wars, right?
Right.
Is he right about that? What makes good science fiction in your view?
Well, I think that he is right. Definitely, science fiction can either be about heroic scientists and engineers or heroic aliens maybe leading us into the future, but it also, especially since the 1960s and certainly in the milieu that Lucas grew up in and then became a director in, there was really a shift to thinking about the social impact of science and technology, right? He grows up in the wake of World War II and then where suddenly after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, we're thinking about science and technology a little differently. And then, of course, living through the 1960s and the massive kinds of social organizations and institutions and people trying to make change, I think all of that really changed how people thought about science fiction and wanted it to speak for people and to be a window into how the world works and how, even if you're just a little person, you can maybe make a difference.
How does science fiction do that? That's a big, expansive explanation, but how does science fiction accomplish that?
Yeah, it has to do that by grabbing your imagination and maybe even your heart to a certain extent, right? So it's got to get your mind. You have to get interested in the problem of the story. Like, how did the world get this way? How can we fix it? How can I do better in my own world? But you also want to care about the characters there. That's part of what your hook is, right? That you see these characters having these experiences and you want the best for them, just like you want the best for your own world.
Yeah, Lisa Jacek is with us. She's a science fiction professor at Georgia Tech. And she is featured in James Cameron's Story of Science Fiction on AMC. How did you become interested in science fiction?
I don't ever remember a world without science fiction. My very first memory in the world is watching Star Trek reruns with my parents and eating organic radishes out of our garden. So clearly I was going to have to either grow up to be an organic farmer or a science fiction person. And I'm glad I went the science fiction route. It's fun.
Black Panther, Avengers, yeah. Infinity War. The James Cameron series is out on AMC. Why are people so interested in sci-fi?
Yeah, well, you know, there's different kinds of science fiction, right? So
yes.
That's something that I think is worth talking about. You've got the big Hollywood blockbusters. I would call those really true sci-fi movies. There are definitely ideas in them, and they're definitely grappling with issues of science and technology and society. But they're really there as much about the action and the adventure and the spectacle. It's so cool, like, to see.
So it's like a dollop of science in this big action movie. I mean, so is a film like Black Panther, is a film like Infinity Wars, is that true science fiction in your eyes?
It's a kind of science fiction, I would say. I don't think it's what in the community we would call science fiction or SF, the best of the best, the stuff that really grapples with hard ideas and makes you see the world differently from a fresh perspective. We certainly get movies like that, and we can get big movies that do that, like Interstellar or Annihilation. But the really big sci-fi blockbusters, they have some hooks to science and technology, but they're there, I think, to capture the emotions of living in the modern moment as much as anything else.
And how important is it for this society to see gender and race diversity in sci-fi films? And that brings me back to Black Panther.
Obviously. Yeah, well, it seems to me critical. Science fiction is one of the only kinds of storytelling we have in the world that makes room for alien voices, right? And so for those of us who might feel alien or alienated by society, this is a genre we can go into and find a place for ourselves. And that's exciting. And I think that's part of what you've really been seeing, even in the great, especially in the great big blockbuster movies and the Marvel movies. So with Black Panther, right, for the first time, we're really getting a story that takes place outside of America and puts America in context to the rest of the world. And so even though it's still a story, so it's a story about a black man, which is awesome. But then it's also the story about all the women who support him as well. And in some ways, that becomes more interesting to watch. Well, what's his sister the scientist doing? What's his queen mother doing? What are all those warriors doing? And the more we get to see that, the more exciting I think the stuff gets. And you still get the big explosions. So you can have it all. I think that's what people need to realize.
That's wonderful. Lisa Jacek is here. She's a professor of science fiction studies at Georgia Tech. Lisa is actually featured in James Cameron's Story of Science Fiction on AMC. The show airs Mondays at 10 Eastern. Lisa, what a pleasure. That was fun.
Oh, it was. Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. It's on Second Thought. Homeless people are repeatedly arrested for public urination. Others have mental health issues that land them in prison. Tomorrow, we will talk about a pilot program in Fulton County to counter these arrests. What do you think should be done to curb homelessness in the state? Have you ever been homeless? You can give us a call at 404-500-9457. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook, and then be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for more. The hashtag MeToo showed up a lot last year on social media. A number of Hollywood personalities came forward to accuse Miramax film founder Harvey Weinstein of sexual abuse. More and more women around the world felt empowered to share their experiences of sexual abuse. In the Me Too era, what role should men play? It is a question my next guests have been thinking a lot about recently. Tony Porter is CEO of the group A Call to Men. He joins us on the line from North Carolina. Tony, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. How you doing?
Terrific. And Coco Pappy is with us. She is a community organizer in Savannah. Coco, welcome back. Yeah, good morning. Welcome back to the show. Tony, for both of you, really, but Tony, let me start with you. It's a step back question, really. Are you convinced that men view sexual harassment in the workplace as a real problem in need of a fix?
You know, I don't know. That's an interesting question. What I do know is that over the many, many years, we've clearly blurred the lines between what men would call flirting, which is actually sexual harassment. What I also know is that as men, you know, we're collectively socialized to view women as objects, particularly sexual objects, which is why I tend to believe that is probably rare that if you find a woman that's been in the workplace for any handful of years that she's never been sexually harassed. Because that line has been blurred a long time ago. So it's really important for we as men to understand that sexual harassment is a form of sexual assault, to get clear on that. We've normalized so many behaviors as men in the various ways that we have less value in women, that we view women as objects, that we view women, particularly as sexual objects, we view women as the property of men.
Right.
And these are men that don't do what we would normally call abusive behaviors. So that line has been blurred. There's a lot going on for us as men and how we've been taught to think and view and spend time with women. So when you look at that all collectively speaking, most of us as men have normalized these behaviors and have very rarely has there been space for us to really talk about it and hash it out and really think about the socialization of men. So the answer to your question is most of us as men probably would not really see it, might see it as a problem, but not to its fullest extent.
Yep.
And how it creates a ripple effect throughout all the experiences of oppression and discrimination
Sure.
that women have.
Sure. Thank you for that, Tony. And Coco, I can't wait to hear your response on this. And I think that for a lot of men, hearing Tony say that flirting is sexual harassment might raise an eyebrow.
Well, I think Mr. Porter brings up a lot of interesting points. I think something that's really important to remember is that women's experiences are vastly different from men's, and we have a culture that has been built on men's experiences, and that filters into every aspect of life, from the workplace to family dynamics to just the way that we view women. And it is a form of sexual assault, in my opinion, right? Who wants to go to their workplace to do their job and to feel like they are experiencing this? Who wants to feel that pressure?
Yeah. Coco, I found something that I want you to think about and respond to here. It's some findings from a Pew Research Center survey released last month. Would you be surprised to hear that the extent to which sexual harassment in the workplace is viewed as a major problem seems to depend on your gender? Maybe that doesn't surprise you as much, but also on your politics, with more liberal men and women viewing sexual harassment in the workplace as a major problem than Republican men and women.
No, I'm not surprised. I think that if you're a conservative and you identify with the traditional ways of how it has always been, you're likely to not get on board with how they're going right now, or even how they can be, right? And this is also taking into consideration just because you have sort of this traditional idea of gender roles doesn't mean it wasn't happening before. There's now just a light shone upon it. So I'm not surprised by that at all.
So, Tony, how do we begin to take on an issue like this? I'm curious as to the work you're doing and what you're hearing from men.
Okay. So, and before I go there, let me just quickly say that flirting in of itself is not necessarily a form of sexual harassment. But the problem with flirting is men are taught from the time we are boys that when you're told no, that means to try harder. Men are taught to have less value in women. So when women say no, we don't immediately always respond to that no in an appropriate way. And so when you take no to mean try harder, trying harder is sexual harassment. So I just want to be clear about that. In regards to men's work, it's really important for we as men to really begin to use the influence that we have, the platform that we have, be it those who are coaching sports, spending time with boys, men who have influence over other men. We really, at a call to men, are intentional in engaging these men to really develop a voice. See, we're the first generation of men who are being asked to speak about healthy manhood. We're the first generation of men being asked to challenge other men for inappropriate behaviors. So as men, collectively speaking, we really don't have a know how to do this. This hasn't been asked of us before in such an intense and purposeful way. All of that's wonderful, but our job right now is to really develop a critical mass of men who can speak to other men about these issues and our role and our responsibility.
Okay, a quick reset here. I'm speaking with Tony Porter. He's the CEO of the group A Call to Men. Also with us is Coco Pappy. She's a community organizer in Savannah. And Tony, let me pick up where you left off. Okay, so this is a call to action. This is a time at which men are being asked to address these issues. So how do you do it? Where do you start? What's the icebreaker for this conversation?
Well, really, one of the things we do with men is talk about promoting healthy manhood, right? We actually will use men's daughters and the women in their lives as a way to enter a conversation. We call it reaching in and grabbing the hearts of men. See, when you think about men collectively, since we were little boys, we've been taught to have a lack of interest in the experience of women and girls. Then we get to a certain age and sexual conquest comes into play, and that's the space where we get permission to be interested in the experience of women and girls. So in general, when we think of men who have an interest in the experience of women and girls, we then look at those men as being less than manly, right? That's what we're taught as boys. So what we're doing, we will start by engaging men around the women that they love, reach in, grab their hearts, right? That usually opens up space to have conversations with men. And then we'll move them, once their intellect gets in play, we'll move them to thinking about women in general. But you have to find an entry point with men to get them invested, because for most of our lives, we've been taught not to be invested in the experience of women and girls outside of those that we love and care about.
Yeah.
Go ahead,
Tony.
It's also really important to engage men around just being healthy with boys. Sometimes it's difficult to talk to men about domestic and sexual violence prevention, but it's very easy to talk to men about engaging boys and being healthy men. So we believe that that's another entry point without even ever talking about sexual violence or sexual assault or sexual harassment. We believe at A Call to Men that if you just increase healthy manhood, just by doing that alone, you're decreasing violence against women and girls.
Okay. Yeah. So Coco, let me have you pick up here a reaction to what you're hearing from Tony. Mm-hmm. And what is the entry point in your mind for men? What is the role of men in the Me Too moment?
Right. Well, and I think that's a really important conversation point, because women have been having this conversation for years, and not always a conversation that was listened to or paid attention to, and sometimes blatantly ignored. And something that I had happen to me when the Me Too movement started was I had so many men that I knew come up to me and say, oh, I identify this. This is so important. What do I do now? And would tell me how much it meant to me and what could they do? And the thing that I would always tell them was, I appreciate this, but I need you to go have these conversations with men. I need you to talk to your sons. I need to talk to your board members. I need to talk to your coworkers. Talk to all the men in your life about what healthy masculinity looks like. And I think that's why it's so important that a call to men exists, is because there has to be space for men to work out those things. Because I don't think it is on the behalf of women that we should be educating men on these things. I think we can share our experiences, but I think men need to have really deep examining conversations about what it means to be a man. If being a man means you have to put someone else of another gender down for you to have masculinity, then that's not a healthy masculinity. That's a toxic masculinity.
Yeah, Tony, I want to replay your comments in the billboard for this show today, and then I've got a question for you.
That women are of less value, property of men, and objects, particularly sexual objects. I've later come to know that to be the collective socialization of men.
So Tony has a certain acceptance of sexual misconduct. In this case, we're talking about workplace harassment. Has that conduct been baked into our society through the way we socialize men in this country and, frankly, around the world to be all kinds of things, namely the head of households, to be leaders? Is it baked in?
You know, I would say it's baked in. That's true. But I'm not going to say because it's baked in that we can't, you know, redo this thing, right? Because it's something that was taught. We're talking about socialization. We're not talking about something that's biologically predetermined. We're talking about what men have been taught. And so if we've been taught that, we can be untaught that, so to say. Right. So it is about the education of men, which is the socialization of men, is about redefining manhood and masculinity. And we can do this. And we're doing this just by virtue of you having a show and having myself and Coco on this show to speak about this issue actually is a sign of progress. Right. The Me Too movement called men out. Right. And it's like a pendulum swing. We've been over to the right for so long, as you called it, baked in, you know, that just men on remote control, be it less value, be it property, be it objectification, we've been over to this far right for a long time. Now this pendulum has swung all the other way, all the way to the left.
Yeah.
And that's the calling out that's happened. What we have to do now, and that calling out has to happen for a while, is intentional. It needs to happen for a while because we've been to the other far side for too long. But then we have to start getting into the middle, like kind of like balancing out. And that's the calling.
Okay, that's
men.
Terrific. That's terrific, Tony. So, Coco, what then are the new rules of the road for men at the workplace? Because here's the crazy disconnect. No man would ever want their daughters to be subjected to sexual harassment.
Right. Well, I think it's taking a deep, hard look and seeing do you have behaviors that are problematic, right? And I think I can't sort of be the person to sit here and prescribe policy for human resources, but I think what I do want to ask of men is to think about how sexism affects your life and your decisions. And I think sexism obviously affects women in a very, very different way than it does men, but I think for so long, men have felt like this is a woman's problem as opposed to a man's problem, right? And so if I am a man and I'm trying to navigate through this discussion, I do not want to be seen as a potential threat to my fellow women, right? I do not want to be seen as a thing that makes them uncomfortable when they come to work or when they go home or when they show up in any space, right? So how can men navigate that? How can men begin to have these conversations where they're talking about what healthy masculinity looks like, right?
Yeah, and Tony, that's it, right? I mean, the idea that no man would ever want their daughters to be subjected to sexual harassment, that seems like a place to start.
Well, it is a place to start because you get to the hearts of men where we believe the transformation begins. But it is also a slippery slope that we don't stay there. We need men to be interested and invested in the experience of all women. Right. And so it's important to find an entry point. But and that's a good one. But we can't stay there. All right. We have to really, as men, be investing in the experiences of all women and not just those that we love and care about.
So, Coco, let me put a little bit more of the political divide business out there. And this is from the Pew survey. And you make of it what you will. 68% of Republican men, 59% of Republican women say it is harder for men to interact with female colleagues, while 45% of Democratic men and 40% of Democratic women feel the same. Do you accept that workplace interaction is now more difficult, harder now with the arrival of the Me Too movement? And if you do, how do you build that bridge?
Well, what is making it hard, right? And I think that's the question we need to ask ourselves. What exactly about this Me Too movement is making it hard for the two genders to interact in the workplace? And I would sort of pontificate and say that if you have anxiety around what this movement means, it might be that you have had some interactions in the past that aren't totally okay, right? And that isn't to say that you need to be tarred and feathered, but again, it's going back to that deep examining of what your behaviors are and how your values and your morals and your politics influence in that, right? And again, I think the really tricky part of this too is, I mean, you let that number out for conservative men, but it's just as high a number for conservative women, right?
Yeah.
So this is, I mean, this is the other really hard thing that we have to talk about is how do we also get women to understand why this is happening, right? How do we get conservative women to understand what this really means? Because I guarantee you, those conservative women have also had this experience, right? Like, this is not a vacuum. This happens to every woman in every situation. So what are the things that we can sort of talk with and build that bridge with conservative women to get them to understand that?
Outstanding. That's Coco Pappy. She's a community organizer in Savannah. And Tony Porter has been our guest. He's the CEO of the group A Call to Men. Thank you both for a wonderful conversation. And that is our show for today. But as always, we want to hear from you. To our male listeners out there involved in the Me Too movement, tell us what encouraged you to answer to call and the call for action right now. Our number is 404-500-9457, or you can post on Twitter or Facebook. We are at OST Talk. For today, that's on Second Thought. From GPB News, I'm Tony Harris. Have a great day.